Dust is everywhere, under our beds, on our computer screens, in cracks on the sidewalk, and on our skin. Particles from the Sahara can be found as far away as the Caribbean, and dust from melting glaciers can have an impact on the Earth's climate. On this week's edition of Please Explain, we'll find out where dust comes from, what it's made of, its positive and negative contributions to the planet, and even to space. Joining us now are Hannah Holmes, author of The Secret Life of Dust, published by Wiley, and Paul Lioi, professor and deputy director of environmental and occupational health sciences at the Robert Wood Johnson Medical School, University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey, author of the forthcoming book, Dust, The Inside Story of Its Role in the September 11th Aftermath. It's published by Roman and Littlefield. Welcome to our show.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Good afternoon.
Paul, how big, or should we say, how small is dust?
Well, dust has, that's one of the unique features of dust. It has a range in size from very, very small, which could be less than what we call one millionth of a meter in diameter, to the size that you see coming out as raindrops.
Well, we see dust seemingly suspended in the air, especially in a beam of light. So can dust float, or I guess the lighter forms float?
Yeah, actually, I think Hannah made a point in one of her books that you can go across oceans with dust, and it depends upon how it's suspended in the air, how it catches itself in the wind, and the size of it. If it's very, very large, it acts more like a rock. You'll be able to lift it up out of the air, and it'll fall to the ground. To teenage boys, usually, it's the material that comes behind the car when you go down a dirt road. It goes up in the air, and it comes back down. When it comes to the inhalation of dust into your lungs, it could be stuff that you really can't see in the air, but may actually penetrate down to the dark recesses of the lung, like the alveoli.
So, Hannah, when we find dust particles from the Sahara in the Caribbean, has it floated across the Atlantic, or has it come by way of people who brought it in the lungs?
Oh, no, it comes by the millions of tons from massive seasonal windstorms that sweep across dry parts of northern Africa. And that wind moves all sizes of particles. But as Paul was saying, the heavier ones, the sand might just hop a few feet. And sand, I forget what the geologists have specific categories. And sand is like, you know, it's a tenth of an inch in diameter, that sand. But if you get smaller than that, then you're in the dust category. And again, the smaller the particle is, the easier it is for it to become entrained in those powerful winds. And if you get a front system that forces air up high, then really the sky's the limit. That dust, as high as it can go around the world, you know, as we see with volcanoes from time to time.
As we saw with Mount St. Helens in 1980.
Right. Yes. So there's a seasonal weather pattern that actually picks up millions of tons of dust from the northern African region and whips it across the Atlantic. And depending on the winds and the season, it dumps it either in the Caribbean and many times a year in Florida, and enough in the Amazon rainforest that it's actually a fertilizer when it lands there, and it has helped to build that ecosystem. So it's a huge amount.
You write about an experiment in which residents of Riverside, California, wore personal dust monitors. Is Riverside a good place because it's right on the outskirts of the California desert?
The funny thing about that study, you know, the EPA clipped these little dust monitors on people's lapels, and just to figure out where we're getting all this dust that ends up in our lungs. And the funny thing about that research was the biggest source of dust for most of the people in that study was their own filthy bodies. And when they took the filters out, they were just crammed with human dust.
It's called the pig pen effect. I think both Hannah and I have probably used that expression in the way we describe dust, because human beings basically are a source of resuspension of material. We flake off parts of our skin, as well as material that may be deposited on our clothing. Some of the clothing itself will deteriorate and cause material in the air. The biggest sources of dust that people have, in addition to their own self, is materials that are in their house and how things abrade in their house and how things are tracked into the house. I found many times that one of the best ways of describing how a family lives in a home is you can actually take samples of either the kitchen floor, especially behind the refrigerator, or rugs, and start analyzing and also doing a forensic analysis of what you've had to eat and what you've had in your home.
In the early 1990s, the EPA announced that the air inside most people's homes is dirtier than the air outside. And obviously, you've explained why. But I've always wondered why, even when the windows are closed, it will gather on the windowsill. Is that something that happens in New York?
On the inside of the windowsill?
Yes, yes. In a city like New York, it's almost guaranteed these little black specks will appear, despite the fact that you've shut that window really tight.
Well, I think Hannah made the good point that these materials, can, if they're small enough, usually when they're less than a micrometer in diameter, they have a very long lifetime. Some of them, in fact, if you put a particle in the middle of a room and there's no movement in the room, it'll stay in that position basically for years. But that's if it's basically a room with no air movement. So therefore, if a particle goes through into the air and it actually, you might say, intercepts a window and there's cracks around the window and you have enough wind speed, the dust particles from outside will get caught in the window well. And sometimes when the window's open, many times you'll have particles from outdoor air going into indoor air.
Now, lead paint anyway, has been banned for decades, and yet we still find lead paint dust in homes. Is that because it just was there and never left?
Well, it deteriorates. The paint on the wall will deteriorate, as well as people, you know, banging into the wall. Children will bang toys onto the wall. Some children, unfortunately, have pica, and therefore they're going to chew on lead painted windowsills. But, you know, over time, things deteriorate. And I'm sure Hannah can tell you some stories about, you know, how things deteriorate and how, you know, the dust is just around us. We do go back to dust.
Well, actually, we say dust to dust, don't we? Hannah, what about other household activities? Could cooking create dust?
It's a tremendous source of dust. And again, as the point Paul was making, is that the dust that we create reflects our lifestyle to some extent. So if you're someone who likes to sauté, then your house dust is going to have little tiny microscopic droplets of oil. You're going to have sort of oily, sticky dust. And if you are someone who likes to bake, then your house dust is going to be sort of, you know, cocoa flavored.
Or flour.
Right. And if you do woodworking for a hobby, you're going to have woody sawdust, woody house dust. It really reflects to an extent what we're doing. But the other phenomenon that's at work is that the whole sorry world is falling apart all around you all the time. And so your drapes are silently shedding little bits of cotton, and every time you sit on the couch, you sort of scrape some fibers off the couch cushions. Your newspaper, when you open it, sends a microscopic shower of paper shreds into the air. Your house plants are perishing all around you, little pieces of them falling onto the floor. Everything is in a state of decay. It's a very tiny state of decay, but it's always happening all around you. Your clothes, as you move, they get grated to shreds. And so dust really inside the house comes from everything that's coming to pieces. But again, it's also coming from outside. The whole world, you know, is in a similar state of decrepitude and coming to pieces and getting thrown around in the air and brought into your house.
Well, you mentioned chocolate, but can I just say chocolate or flour is dust of a sort?
No, yes.
Yeah. And what about, do they have their own dust attached to them? Does flour have dust?
That's a wonderful philosophical question. You know, do fleas have fleas? There's a fabulous category of dust that happens in the handling of various grains, and that can be really perilous, actually. Dust explosions, where you're moving a lot of grain, and the dust is grated off the grains one at a time. So if you're moving flour or corn, it happens with silos in the West on a regular basis. You move this stuff enough, and it grates off enough dust, and it's suspended in the air, and these tiny particles have a huge surface area for static electricity and regular electricity to work on, and they can catch fire and cause a massive explosion where you really didn't see anything that could burn.
Now, sure. I want to get to all sorts of other forms of dust, but Paul can't stay with us throughout the whole show, so I wanted to get the dust.
Well, I have a little bit more flexibility than before, so.
Oh, good. Well, let's talk about 9/11 anyway, because it's so important to New York, and that's what your book is about. There was a great deal of concern about the dust from the collapsed World Trade Center following 9/11.
Sure.
How far did it travel?
Well, at least it traveled throughout southern Manhattan, and some of the dust traveled over into Brooklyn. And clearly, the smaller particles, which probably didn't deposit anywhere, probably traveled out to sea. Again, I think as we both were saying, is that dust has many, many different sizes. One of the unique things about the World Trade Center dust, which I've reported on in the scientific literature and others have too, is that it was a fairly large size because this was basically what we call a mechanical decay of a building, very, very rapid, and it was a horrible reason why. And you created a bunch of large particles, and most of them were cement, and some of them were cellulose. Basically, what Hannah was talking about in terms of, you know, things that can decay, this stuff decayed very rapidly, and we ended up with a lot of material that you don't normally find in dust. And one of the most serious issues that came out of it is that when you have something like cement, you will have a high basic nature of it because the chemical composition of all dust is different, and that would irritate the lung. In addition, we had a lot of glass fiber. We had a lot of fiberglass, and that get caught in the upper airways of the lung. So it was a serious problem. It was a complex mixture that we've never seen before. And you put on top of that the gases that were released that we never could detect, and the smoke. You have what we call an aerosol. And I think what Tana talks about when things move, it's basically the suspension of particles in an airstream, which is an aerosol, and it will change depending upon size, composition, what other factors like rain will wash it out. So you could see 9/11 was an event that fits into this constellation of things that can happen when material turned back to dust.
Now, the EPA cleaned certain apartments in the vicinity of the World Trade Center. How do cleaners eliminate dust like that, or can they? After all, we go to the store and we buy those things that say they'll pick up dust. Are they really effective?
Well, you need a constellation of different types of techniques. You need both you need vacuum cleaners that have filtration systems that contain the dust. You also need to wash down walls. You need to wash materials that can be saved. Other things have to be removed, and you can never reclaim them because the dust is just too embedded in them. So you have a whole series of techniques that one has to employ. In fact, one of the things I said about what the EPA did is they did a rapid turnaround in terms of trying to figure out how to clean up homes in such a quick period of time, because most of the time when you deal with the events that we've concerned ourselves with in the past, it's been, you know, material that were deposited in the home because of a flood, which can turn to dust, but it's not the same type.
Before we go to a little break, I do want to address the whole matter of dust bunnies. What is dust clumped together, Hannah? Is there a certain kind of dust that's more likely to be under our beds?
Well, here's the thing that we don't think about, and that is that weather continues indoors. The wind doesn't stop at your walls and windows. Wind comes right around your windows and doors. There are always places for air to get in and the dust that is suspended in it. But then just walking from one end of your house to another creates a little tiny weather system because you leave a wake of roiling air behind you. What you'll notice when you think about this is that your dust bunnies never collect in the places where you walk all the time. There's enough wind, if you will, to drive the bunnies off into the corners. So basically, the wind that you create by walking around pushes the dust into quieter corners where it settles and, you know, grows and takes on a life of its own.
Wow.
It's called microturbulence.
Yeah, so if you were never microturbulent, then you would never have dust bunnies. It would be a very even layer of dust like you find in your attic.
But are you more likely to have a lot of dust bunnies if you have carpeting and other contributors to dust?
Oh yeah, and nothing
a
built
fireplace, a nice fireplace on a snowy winter evening.
That and a husky dog.
Anything that produces fibers is a good basis for starting a dust bunny. And once you have them, then they start gathering other things up. It's a process of coagulation, and then agglomeration that proceeds to, I think, lead to the buildup that Hannah was talking about.
We have to take a little break, and when we come back, we will be taking listener calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. You can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. The subject on today's Please Explain is dust, and we are talking with Paul Lioi, Professor and Deputy Director of Environmental and Occupational Health Sciences at the Robert Wood Johnson Medical School, University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey. His book, Dust, The Inside Story of the Role of the September 11th Aftermath, will soon be published by Roman and Littlefield. Already out is Hannah Holmes' book, The Secret Life of Dust, published by Wiley. Stay with us. We're back with our guest, Paul Lioi, Professor and Deputy Director of Environmental and Occupational Health Sciences at the Robert Wood Johnson Medical School, University of Medicine and Dentistry at New Jersey. His forthcoming book from Roman and Littlefield is Dust, The Inside Story of Its Role in the September 11th Aftermath. And also with us is Hannah Holmes, who's written a book about dust in general called The Secret Life of Dust, which is published by Wiley. Our number here is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. So let's talk a bit more about the different kinds of dust there are. Paul, is air pollution dust?
Well, air pollution can be put in the category of dust, but dust usually is considered the larger materials, although if you take Hannah's definition, yes, it is. It's very tiny dust. The thing that's interesting about air pollution dust is that it's not just what you find in the source, let's say, you have dust that's a starch on the floor. It can actually be something that's formed in a stack, formed in the emissions from a car, and actually formed in the atmosphere from chemistry. So you have this whole range of interesting material, which you can classify under Hannah's definition of dust, that gives you an opportunity to look at a lot of physical chemical processes, and then associate with that dust that would can be considered biologically active material, which can lead to other types of endpoints, like disease endpoints, such as asthma if you're inhaling an allergen. So there's a whole host of things that could come under the heading of dust that's part of air pollution.
So, Hannah, what are the most common forms of dust that will cause respiratory infections?
One of the problems with the definition of dust, as Paul was pointing out, is that a lot of the stuff in the air actually is sort of a shapeshifter. It can go from liquid to solid and back again, depending on the circumstance. So it bedevils you to try to classify what you're inhaling. You're inhaling a million different things. People tend to become allergic to something to which they are overexposed. That said, once you have a hyper-responsive respiratory tract, a respiratory tract that's sort of prone to hysteria, an awful lot of things can bring on that hysterical response besides the original thing that you might be allergic to.
Well, for example, I've heard that one of the reasons we're seeing such high asthma rates in poor neighborhoods is that there are a lot of cockroaches, and the dust that they create causes asthma. Is that possible?
Absolutely. And the billions of humans who have been told they're allergic to dust, they're actually allergic to dust mite doo-doo,
right,
which is a very specific kind of house dust. It's quite common because dust mites are sort of the sheep of the indoor dust ecosystem. They're grazing everywhere in your house. And
they live off of the dust.
They actually...
Even though dust is inert?
They're endearing little creatures. And actually do an immense service to humanity by eating the huge quantities of skin flakes that you shed in the average day. If they weren't eating it, it would build up around your ankles and be incredibly foul. But these adorable little creatures, they have no head. They're completely dedicated to the task of cleaning up after you. And they spend all day and all night, without sleep, without cease, shoving your skin into their mouths.
Paul, does dust have any benefits?
Well, if you want to look at a benefit, the way in which people get exposed to allergens and things like that when they're young, if in fact, and they found this on farms, if you're more interactive with the materials in your yard and the world around you, and the dust particles come off of let's say hay or other objects or man-made and also and animals, you actually may build up a tolerance, so you may have a reduced possibility of asthma. There's a real debate between does early exposure to dust help you get a better immune system, or do you not expose yourself to dust at all?
This is the same idea as being exposed to dirt.
Yeah.
Because many people are concerned that today, with all the those antibiotic washes and the like, we are actually making our kids more vulnerable in the future.
Yeah, I hate when I see these television commercials where they have mothers spraying an aerosol, a dust, some way, you might say an aerosol, particles, maybe on their kids' toys, which I think is sort of odd because you're spraying a chemical to kill a bacterium and you're trying to survive in a world of particles of all different types. So it's hard to say that it has a benefit. I think most people clean their houses because they don't think it's a benefit to have particles in a house. So it's hard to say. If in terms of the globe, if we didn't have large dust particles, we would have a lot hotter planet, because sometimes the particles in the atmosphere do, in fact, interfere with the it actually reflects the sunlight back into the space.
We have some callers calling in. Should we take some?
I was going to ask Hannah, do you have any suggestions on that question?
On the benefits of dust.
Well, the thing that brought me to write this book in the first place was when a geologist explained to me that you can't make a raindrop without a piece of dust.
Oh, that's true. I hadn't thought about that.
I mean, things would get mighty parched down here if it weren't for the dust that is constantly circling overhead. And there's, tons and tons of it that is always circulating, and it's made up of everything on Earth. And water molecules clamp onto that and are able to build up enough weight to form a raindrop, and they can't do that without
snowflake
dust
as well?
Yep.
Yep. Now, Sam, that was perfect. I had forgotten all about that. That is an excellent, excellent reason why dust is necessary.
Okay, let's take some calls. Virginia from Manhattan, you're on the air.
Hey, Leonard. It's a wonderful show. Listen, before I ask my question, I have to say that I'm on a very tight budget, and I don't take the newspaper or pay for cable. But I am a member of WNYC. Last summer I got the New York Times, New Yorker offer, and I've been enjoying it. And yesterday I called in and gave an extra little topper-upper.
Yay!
Yeah, so anyway, my question is, this is really fascinating about dust and 9/11. I live six blocks east of 9/11 near the corner of Fulton and Gold on the 22nd floor. Now, our building got thoroughly, covered, and all the dust, came into all the little crevices.
Sure.
And I have three questions. One is, we don't have any bugs after 9/11. Before 9/11, we'd sometimes have cockroaches and sometimes have, silverfish. Haven't seen a thing since 9/11. And then the next question is, sometimes for exercise, I walk up the stairs, 22 flights of stairs, instead of taking the elevator, but I can't do that anymore because every time I do it, I get an awful cough. And third question is, what kind of air cleaner should we use in our house?
Wow, those are three big questions.
Yeah.
One, I have no idea why the cockroaches are dead. Hannah, do you have an idea?
I think the asbestos killed them.
I think that the dust is definitely still in the walls.
Well, you probably will have dust some dust in the walls forever. I mean, if it got into the house and got into the walls, it will. But there is no way that you can clean up everything. I mean, the main thing is that the majority of it will be stuck in the walls and it'll stay there until they tear the building down. As far as what causes your respiratory illnesses, that is hard to say. I mean, you'd have to be looked at by a physician. We have a number of groups that deal with people who have had 911 related illnesses. Mount Sinai is one group that looks at a number of folks. So I would refer you to them, because I would be really out of school trying to explain that to you at this point in time. The main thing with 911 is where you were, how long you were there, how much contact you had with the dust, and how dusty your house was before you went back and lived in a residence. And for air cleaners, it all depends upon what kind of air conditioning you have. If you have room air conditioning, you have good filters on your air conditioner. If you have a building air conditioning system, what kind of filters you have in the building, and what kind of approach they use to maintaining
well,
it.
Well, Paul, we have another question along
sure.
these lines, and maybe this will help. Paul from Washington Heights, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. After 9/11, we received an offer in the mail, I think from the federal government, to subsidize the purchase of air cleaning machines.
Mm-hmm.
And we purchased something called an electrostatic air cleaner, the Ionic Breeze Quadra.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wondered, we've been using it for a while, but I just wonder, how do they work? And are there any downsides to using an ionic electrostatic air cleaner?
Well, if you're using an electrostatic air cleaner, what you're doing is basically, I think as Hannah said before, the particles have charges on them and you'll collect the material. I don't know exactly what it looks like. You'd probably be collecting the charged particles on some sort of filtration system. The only thing you worry about with electrostatic charging is the production of ozone. If you have good airflow in your house, I wouldn't be too much of a concern.
Thank you so much for your call. Paul, I know you have to leave now,
yes.
But I want to thank you so much for participating. Hannah will stay. Paul Lioi is Professor and Deputy Director of Environmental and Occupational Health Sciences at the Robert Wood Johnson Medical School, University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey. His book coming out, when is it coming out?
It should be out Monday or Tuesday next week.
Oh, really soon.
Yeah, available on Barnes & Noble on the 16th.
Roman and Littlefield is the publisher. Dust, the inside story of its role in the September 11th aftermath. Also, and thank you so much for being with us,
us. And thank you, Hannah, for putting up with me. I really do appreciate your comments. They're excellent. And, Len, thank you very much. I have
to
run.
Pleasure.
But have a good day all and have a very nice weekend.
I want to remind people that Hannah Holmes's book is called The Secret Life of Dust, and it's published by Wiley. Let's take some more calls, and we go now to John from New Jersey. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi, Leonard. Hi, Hannah. Thanks for doing this. This is a really interesting topic. My wife and I just had a baby at the beginning of February, and we're in the process of looking for houses and things like that, and a lot of these are fixer-uppers, and we've been looking at different kinds of things to use on the flooring surfaces, and a lot of the manufacturers say that the carpeting manufacturers say that the best thing to put in your house to keep the dust down is carpet. But it sounds like from some of the things that Hannah was saying before, that anything that is made of fibers is probably a great source for creating dust. That's one of the issues. The other thing is we also use one of the ion filtration systems, and we were a little bit concerned about the ozone thing. But we also use a humidifier since it's so dry, and we notice a white dust. I guess it's like a calcium dust that comes into the air and settles over everything. Just wondered what you have to say about these different kinds of sources of domestic dust, and what's best to use in a house.
Oh boy, this is a touchy topic, but I have pretty much nothing good to say about carpeting. The general
it keeps the noise. It makes the neighbors happy, doesn't it? Because they don't hear you.
It certainly provides them sound insulation, but it's a deep. I think of your house as an environment for a whole ecosystem of animals, And the primary one, again, is those dust mites. And carpet is a beautiful habitat for dust mites. They get down into it, and they can hang on to the fibers tightly enough that you can't vacuum them out. You can vacuum out the dust mite poop, which is what people get allergic to, but you can't actually suck the little buggers off of their little carpet fibers.
Not even my Dyson can do that.
Not even.
So the thank you for calling us. So the mites are both eating up the dust, but also creating another kind of dust.
Yeah, they're converting your skin into little balls of feces that float in the air.
And are they worse than the things that come up our skin?
Well, it's six of one and a half dozen of the other. There's nothing wrong with human skin. You're not going to become allergic to it. It's really part of you. And so if you were able to vacuum it up before the dust mites got to it, it wouldn't really make any difference. But the dust mite population, as it grows in your house, if you vacuum less and less of your own skin off the floor and leave it for the dust mites, that population will grow, and the number of fecal particles that float around in the air when you shake your blankets will grow as well, and that's what ends up causing allergy.
Now, the caller talked about having a newborn. A lot of people put talcum powder on the baby. You say that's not such a good idea.
Well, you're just introducing another dust, and it's important to watch carefully what goes into the talcum powder that you use. And in fact, talc is something that you may wish to avoid in favor of cornstarch. But to get back to the carpet, this is actually a fairly important source of all kinds of toxins for crawling children. They crawl across carpets, and the dust that has settled deep into them since you last vacuumed sticks to their gummy little fingers, and then if you've ever watched a baby, it will tend to sit for a minute and think about life on Earth and stick that hand in its mouth and suck the hand. And then when it's figured out the mysteries, it will crawl on another few feet and gather another handful of dust. They've done studies on how much dust kids eat this way by crawling across carpet and floor, and it amounts to something like half a cup by the time they're six or eight.
Wow.
It's a huge amount of very tiny and very reactive particles.
Let's take another call. Aviva from Park Slope. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. You know, just listening to what you just said about carpet, I'm wondering why is carpet legal when there's so many kids with asthma, but also in New York City, I mean, you would think they would have laws that you can require your landlord to take out the carpet. But my question really was about my son, who's five and has pneumonia for the second time this winter, and it seems to not be going away. We're worried about him, and we have carpet all over our apartment, and we're renting. So we try to get the landlord to take it out, but he doesn't want to. And we're going to move it by the summer, so our lease is up. But
do you think that's
causing his pneumonia? Is that possible, that could be doing it?
There's no way to know. There are some things you can do to minimize the risk, and that what they found is that when you vacuum, and you vacuum often with carpet, you vacuum each piece of carpet eight times. That's eight passes with the vacuum. You don't whisk, whisk, whisk. You go back and forth and back and forth eight times, and that actually pulls the deep dirt up out where your kids can't reach it. If you go quickly, if you do two passes, you're actually pulling deep contaminants up to the surface right where kids can gather them.
Now, what about molds, and which sometimes form on ceilings? Do they also cause dust, the kind of dust that can cause us problems?
Yeah, they are dust, you know, technically. They're little particles that can float around. And then their manner of reproduction is really just to puff more dust into the air in the form of spores. And again, to think of your house as an ecosystem, fungus is sort of the grass of the ecosystem. And if your house is moist enough, just like outdoors in your yard, if it's moist enough, grass will grow. If your house is moist enough, fungus will grow. And it does reproduce, not with a pollen, but by puffing out little spores that then can become very thick in damp houses and cause a great deal of discomfort and allergy.
It's a good reason to have ventilation in a steamy bathroom. Manny from Long Island, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you? My son, actually, he's 13 now, but when he was born, he was, after when he was 3 years old, he was on he had a severe case of asthma, and I was doing carpet cleaning at the time, and then I got into mold remediation because of his allergies. I found that rubbing alcohol put into an electric fogger and fogged in your house eliminates a lot of the dust, and you know, it actually helped his allergies.
Does alcohol help? And let me push it a little further, Hannah. If you are concerned about your flaking skin, can you just use rubbing alcohol to cut down on the dust that you're creating?
Now, alcohol would kill living things like mold spores and bacteria and viruses, but I'm not sure that puffing it into the air is going to reach enough of those things unless you're doing huge quantities. In terms of your skin, again, there's nothing particularly noxious about human skin. It just creates that food base for your dust mites. So the best way to deal with it is just to scrub it off in the shower in the morning and hope that most of it ends up down the drain instead of following you around the house.
Can we escape dust? I hear that there's even dust in outer space.
Well, good thing. The dust in outer space comes from stars. When they die, they explode in hot gases. As those gases condense in the cold coldness of outer space, they form little tiny particles called space dust. And this stuff has fabulous little tiny elements in it, and they form tiny diamonds and sapphires, and they're really exotic. When they get together in enough concentration in space, they start to form sort of dust bunnies in space. And when those get big enough, they develop gravity, which pulls them tighter together, and they start to heat up. And eventually they get so hot and compressed that they poof and turn into stars. And all the leftover dust that might be circling that ball of dust forms its own little marbles and bolsters and beach balls and grows into planets. So without space dust, no planet.
And we wouldn't have had Stardust by Hoagy Carmichael, and that would have been a great loss as well. Thank you so much for participating in today's Please Explain look at dust. I've been talking with Hannah Holmes. Her book, The Secret Life of Dust, is published by Wiley. And obviously we couldn't cover it all. You'll want to read that book. It's a lot of fun. Thank you so much, Hannah.
Great to be here.